This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, June 25th, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up on today's program, Iran's opposition leader says he will continue to challenge the election results despite government efforts to silence protesters. The Federal Reserve Chair faces some tough questions from Congress over his involvement in the Merrill Lynch bailout. And Afghanistan's government trains thousands of police to provide security during the August presidential elections. All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In an 8-1 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled Stafford, Arizona school officials violated a 13-year-old girl's Fourth Amendment rights when they conducted a strip search on her. FSRN's Amanda Shauger reports from Tucson.
The case stems from an incident at an Arizona middle school where administrators conducted a strip search of Savannah Redding because of a tip she was carrying prescription-strength ibuprofen. Another student found with the medicine pointed to Redding as the source, but no pills were ever found. The court said that school searches, quote, will be permissible when the measures adopted are reasonably related to the objectives of the search and not excessively intrusive in light of the age and sex of the student and the nature of the infraction. This means the ibuprofen did not pose a significant danger to others, and there was no reasonable reason to search the teen's underwear for the pills. But the court also said school officials are not liable in the case because the original law did not clearly signify that strip searches in this situation violated the Fourth Amendment. Amanda Shauger, FSRN, Tucson.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder says new hate crimes legislation is necessary. Today he spoke before the Senate Judiciary Committee to defend the Matthew Shepard Hate Crimes Prevention Act, which extends protections based on sexual orientation, gender identity, and disability status.
There's no question that with regard to the vast majority of these crimes, they would be handled by the state. But for those cases that protect, that pose particular problems or expose an inability or unwillingness for the states to prosecute them, we think that there is the demonstrated need for the federal government to become involved.
But Republican Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama and many of his fellow party members don't like the idea of what they refer to as special protections.
There are lots of other groups, people, decent people, that might need additional federal protection if the federal government had all the money in the world and all the time to investigate this.
Democrats have been trying to pass updated hate crimes legislation for years. New York Senator Charles Schumer.
It's hard for me to understand how anybody can oppose that. If we vote down this legislation, in a certain sense, we are saying it is okay to physically harm people who you don't like because of who they are.
According to a Leadership Conference on Civil Rights report, the rate of hate crimes in the U.S. is nearly one per hour. A bill that would establish stringent new standards for future free trade agreements has been introduced in Congress. From WERU Radio in Maine, FSRN's Meredith DeFrancesco reports.
The Trade Reform, Accountability, Development, and Employment, or TRADE Act, has garnered the support of 106 co-sponsors, led by Maine Congressman Mike Michoud, the chairman of the House Trade Working Group. The Trade Act would require all involved countries to adhere to labor, environmental, product safety, and human rights standards. It also addresses the privatization of public services, intellectual property rights, and procurement policies. Even more significantly, the Act would require a review and potential renegotiation of a number of current trade agreements, including NAFTA, CAFTA, and the World Trade Organization's Uruguay Round agreements. Several unions, civil rights organizations, and environmental groups endorse the new trade bill. Meredith DeFrancesco, FSRN, Blue Hill, Maine.
North Korea has renewed threats against the West, saying in the country's state-run newspaper that the dark clouds of a nuclear war are gathering as the hours tick by. This comes in response to the U.S. offering South Korea the protection of a nuclear umbrella. In response, U.S. Defense Department spokesperson Jeff Morrell said,
I don't even know how I even respond to such silliness.
The U.S. is currently tracking a North Korean ship they believe to be carrying arms and military supplies, a violation of a recent U.N. security resolution. Again, Morrell.
That is a decision I think we will likely take collectively with our allies and partners out there and make a determination about whether we choose to hail and query this particular ship. And if we make that decision, when and where to do so. But that is not a decision that's been made yet, and I don't get the sense that it is imminent.
Morrell says the responsibility lies with every nation that signed on to the UN resolution. As the H1N1 pandemic continues to spread around the world, the virus is disproportionately affecting certain groups of people. One of those groups is the First Nations communities across Canada. First Nations chiefs in Manitoba have declared a state of emergency as the situation worsens. FSRN's Amy Miller has more.
The World Health Organization declared H1N1 a worldwide pandemic on June 11th, a move that many First Nation communities hoped would prompt Canada's federal government to release emergency funds, particularly to the numerous remote northern communities hit hardest by the flu. Instead, a Senate debate on whether to send alcohol-based hand sanitizer into Native communities perceived to have addiction problems delayed some supply shipments. This has caused outrage among First Nations chiefs across Manitoba who have called on Health Canada for an apology. Currently, Manitoba has the highest swine flu infection rate in Canada. Over half of all confirmed cases are First Nation residents, even though they make up only 10% of the province's population. While social and economic conditions, such as lack of running water and substandard housing, have contributed to the disproportionate number of Native peoples affected by the virus, health officials have yet to understand why First Nations people are affected more severely than others. Amy Miller, FSRN, Montreal.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
In Iran today, opposition candidate Mir Hussein Mousavi published a statement on his website saying he will continue to challenge the June 12 election results and called on his supporters to continue peaceful protests. No reports surfaced today of demonstrations after news was circulated Wednesday via social media and internet videos of riot police and pro-government militiamen using clubs and tear gas to break up an opposition rally in front of Iran's parliament. Mousavi blamed those behind the, quote, rigged elections for the violence that has been unleashed against protesters. Iran state media reports that at least 25 people have died in clashes between opposition supporters and pro-government forces since the elections, but figures are difficult to confirm as reporters face severe restrictions on where and when they can work. Mousavi says the government shut down his newspaper and is restricting his access to his supporters. The opposition leader hasn't been seen in public for days, and he said that authorities arrested 70 university professors who met with him yesterday. Western countries have been severely critical of the Iranian government's reaction to the protests, with President Obama recently saying he was appalled and outraged by the crackdown on protesters. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad called on Obama to stop interfering in Iran's affairs and to stop behaving like President Bush. Ahmadinejad held an election victory party in Tehran today, with state media reporting that almost two-thirds of Iran's MPs did not attend. Iran's 290 members of parliament had been invited to the celebration, but local sources say that only about a third showed up. In Washington, the Obama administration said it will no longer invite Iranian diplomats to attend a 4th of July party at the White House. Violence is peaking in Afghanistan as the Central Asian country approaches its presidential elections. The Afghan army reported it killed 23 Taliban fighters earlier this week during combats in Uruzgan province, while battles continue to take place in several parts of the country. Concerned about this violence, the Afghan government has decided to train 35,000 police to maintain security during the August 20th elections. These will be only the second presidential elections in Afghanistan's turbulent history. Zubair Babarkail sent us this report from Kabul.
"25 high-level police officers are sitting in a hotel ballroom in Kabul a handwritten chapter from a training manual entitled Human Rights and Election hangs on a board. And a trainer from European Union Police is teaching through his young Afghan female interpreter. The training of the high-level police officials is a joint initiative of the Afghan Interior Ministry, United Nations Development Programme and the European Union Police. The police officers are from the eastern and southeastern provinces of Khost, Lagman, Kunar and Nuristan of Afghanistan, where the Taliban insurgency continues to rage. Basir Gul is from Nuristan province.
People in our area are frustrated. They're worried about the security situation. There are at least 4 incidents a week in our province. Bomb blasts, suicide attacks and gunfire are becoming a part of the daily routine, so people think they'll be killed if they vote. What we have to do is to provide good security for them so that they can leave their homes without being afraid to choose their president.
He says with little experience in managing elections, security personnel, many of whom have only recently been recruited, have a lot to learn before August. A 47-year-old farmer, Shaga, is watering his pasture on a sunny afternoon in Kabul. He says security is the most important issue for the 5 members of his family eligible to vote in August.
Life is hard with the ongoing war. People say the Taliban are getting near Kabul, so we are afraid to go to polling centers. Maybe they will attack those areas. Of course you want to vote, but we need to feel comfortable about security.
Interior Ministry officials say the police would be trained in professional skills for strengthening security. Major General Gulnabi Ahmad Zay is the head of Police Education Department.
Our training includes how to remain fair and nonpartisan in the elections, not to work for a specific candidate, keep the voting center secure, and teach voting guidelines and good behavior on voting day.
After the removal of Taliban from Kabul in 2001, the government today has 86,000 national police personnel and 90,000 soldiers in Afghan National Army. Alongside Afghan security personnel, around 70,000 foreign soldiers of US-led coalition forces and NATO will also help to ensure election security. Many say the situation now is much worse than when the first presidential elections were held in 2004. Iqbal Khan, a shopkeeper here in Kabul, cast his vote in the last election.
This time it's different. During the first election we had big hopes and enthusiasm, but that's not the case now. Security is bad and the government isn't any good. I haven't yet decided if I'm going to cast my vote this time.
Besides local Afghans, some of the presidential election candidates are also concerned about their own security. Mirwais Yasini is one of the 41 contenders of the presidential race. He says he is facing threats from contesting in the polls.
Well, I'm deeply concerned about my security and the security of my running mates. Well, I mean, they have to maximize the security arrangement and they have to satisfy the candidates about their security and what level they are getting to be satisfied. I mean, the security of President Karzai, who is an incumbent president, is completely different with the other ones. So that they have to bring the security levels to the level that the candidates or the running mates can be satisfied.
Inshallah.
Zmaray Bashari is the spokesperson for the ministry. He says that the government has decided to provide better security for presidential candidates.
We have a really broad and comprehensive security plan for the security of elections. This plan is not only applied to the security of the process of election, but also the security of the candidates is concerned here. We have a plan to give 20 trained police men for every candidate to provide security for him.
41 candidates, including two women, are contesting for the president's office. And another 3,300 candidates are in the run for provincial council seats. Last week, presidential candidate Dr. Dawood Miraki withdrew his candidacy. And if Taliban elements continue their sporadic attacks, civilians may not come out to vote in big numbers and many more candidates may back out. Zubair Babakar Khil, FSRN, Kabul.
The White House yesterday confirmed President Obama's plans to remove U.S. soldiers from cities and towns in Iraq next week. Despite two bomb explosions that killed two and injured more than 30 people today, and a motorcycle bomb that killed more than 60 people in Baghdad's Sadr city on Wednesday. At home, Iraq Veterans Against the War, a grassroots organization of vets opposed to U.S. wars, continues to organize winter soldier hearings across the country. It's a venue where veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan can tell stories from their war days in an environment that's safe and supportive. Leo Paz reports from Los Angeles.
Ryan Endicott is a former Marine corporal who did multiple tours in Iraq and returned to the United States in 2006. He talked about what it's like for U.S. Marines to enforce martial law in a foreign country.
Young boys, 18 to 22, have martial law over a group of people. It's complete oppression, and it actually borders on the line of terrorism. When, I mean, you strap dead bodies to a Humvee and drive around a city with it, that's terrorism. That's scaring a group of people into your belief system and structure, and that's exactly what we're doing. We're terrorizing people.
Corporal Endicott, who was in Ar-Ramadi, Iraq, said these are not isolated incidents, but daily occurrences.
Every single day, every time you kick in a door and drag a man out of his bed in the middle of the night, that's terrorism. That's not, we're not saving people, that's not liberation. You don't liberate people by kicking in their doors and arresting people by mass numbers, by shooting them. That's not liberation, that's occupation.
Some of the soldiers recall the harsh treatment of Iraqi civilians stopped at the numerous checkpoints installed by the U.S. throughout the country. Former Marine Corporal Christopher Gallagher compared the checkpoints in Haditha and Fallujah to herding cattle.
If any Iraqis voiced their opinion for the way they were being treated, the Iraqi police we had at our checkpoint would handle the situation by harassing and assaulting them.
According to Gallagher, when the U.S. military went door-to-door in the middle of the night, raiding homes to eliminate any resistance to the occupation, Iraqis held massive protests. Gallagher described a typical U.S. response to these protests.
In 2004, the Iraqis would hold protests in the town of Haditha against the occupation. Typical response for this was to have fighter jets fly over the crowd and scare them away.
Corporal Endicott questioned the sanitized version of war portrayed in mainstream American media.
Yeah, what should be on the media is the thousands of doors that are kicked in every day and the thousands of people that are terrorized by U.S. soldiers that are pumped up on adrenaline and just looking to kill people. I mean, there's plenty of people that join the military simply to kill people.
Endicott is one of many vets who denounced the indiscriminate shooting of civilians by U.S. military. Devon Reed, a former Marine infantry sergeant, who took part in the invasion of Iraq in 2003, saw comrades anxious to fire at whatever came in their path. He told people at Winter Soldier about driving through Nasiriya, speeding on the way to Baghdad on the back of a Humvee, and Marines in his unit shooting randomly at people in houses.
You know, none of the grunts that wanted to shoot people really cared about that. If it was an opportunity to shoot someone, you know, they'd be shooting. So there's two of us on my side of the vehicle and three guys on the other side of the vehicle, and we're facing outboard. And suddenly the guys on the other side of the vehicle start shooting, and I'm curious what the heck they're shooting about, but I can't really look because I'm trying to pay attention to my side. And then the other guy that's with me decides to switch sides, switches over to the other side, and starts shooting also. And I finally take a moment to look, and I'm looking, and they're all just shooting wildly.
Sergeant Reed, who was appalled at the random gunfire, wondered how many civilians had been shot by U.S. troops that day.
There's, you know, people in windows way off in the distance. Who really knows? There's plenty of civilians, but they're, you know, poking their heads out the window. But it's just someone to shoot at, and there's shooting going on. So no one's going to ask any questions if they start pulling the trigger, too. So everyone just starts shooting, just randomly. And, you know, I talked to everyone afterwards, and none of them had any idea what they were shooting at or why.
Many Vietnam War vets showed up to support the IVAW and the Iraq veterans in denouncing war and violence. Ed Garza, an Army gunner with the 173rd Airborne Brigade, still has nightmares 40 years after the war.
I remember the dead bodies. I remember seeing them. And I remember we used to kill a Vietnamese and we'd put our patch on them to remind the other Vietnamese in the area that we were there, the 173rd Airborne. So those are some of the things I remember.
According to a study conducted by Iraqi doctors and published in a British medical journal, Iraqi dead are in the hundreds of thousands since the U.S. invasion in 2003. Afghan civilians are estimated at more than 10,000 dead. Now into the eighth year of war, more than 5,000 soldiers have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, according to the U.S. military. Leo Paz, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Today, Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke was in the hot seat as he answered questions from a House of Representatives Oversight Committee about the government's involvement in the purchase of Merrill Lynch by Bank of America. Committee members say Bernanke pressured Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis to go through the Merrill Lynch deal even though he didn't want to, causing what was supposed to be a private deal to become a $20 billion bailout. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Last September, Bank of America announced that it was going to acquire Merrill Lynch. But just a few months later on, it was reported that Merrill Lynch had a $15 billion loss. In his testimony Thursday, Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke said Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis was considering backing out of the Merrill Lynch deal by invoking what's called a material adverse event, or MAC clause. The MAC would have ended the deal. Bernanke said because the markets were so unsteady, he advised Lewis to go through with the deal, but added it was still his choice to make. But that contradicts recent testimony from Ken Lewis, who just 2 weeks ago told Congress that Bernanke and former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson indicated that if Bank of America did not acquire Merrill Lynch, Lewis and the Bank of America board would be fired. Committee member Dan Burton from Indiana asked Bernanke about it.
Is Mr. Lewis lying?
With respect to what, sir?
I said, is Mr. Lewis lying when he tells this committee that you put pressure on him along with Mr. Paulson?
All I know is that I never said that I would replace the board and management if he invoked the MAC.
What did you say? I mean, you know, sometimes there's an implication without a direct order.
I expressed concerns about the effects of invoking the MAC, both on the financial system and on the Bank of America itself. Expressed those concerns, which is appropriate, but it was always his decision whether or not to go ahead and take that decision.
Lewis ended up going through with the deal. Some members of the committee questioned the government's involvement in telling a CEO of a private company what to do. Congressmember Bill Foster from Illinois.
Do you believe that there is any need for any additional legal clarity about the duties of a CEO to the shareholders, to the regulators, and to the overall economy in times of systemic crisis?
Well, that might be something for Congress to consider, but I think the rules as they currently stand are quite clear that you can't force somebody to take actions against the interest of their own company for systemic reasons alone.
Okay, so you did not sense at any time in this that there were ambiguities that would be better if they were had been made explicit in law?
It was always clear in our thinking and in our advice to Mr. Lewis that it was not just an issue of the financial system, but also an issue of Bank of America specifically, that was at risk, and that he should take that into consideration when he made his decision.
Committee members also questioned Bernanke about the secrecy around the deal. Recently released documents released by the committee show emails sent from the Federal Reserve indicating there should be little information released about the Bank of America, Merrill Lynch merger. In his testimony, however, Bernanke said he had followed all disclosure rules. President Obama has recently released a proposal to give extended powers to the Federal Reserve. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
This week, members of the Healthy School Food Brigade, which includes parents and other healthy food advocates, traveled to Capitol Hill to urge Congress to eliminate junk food from American schools. Melissa Langer reports from Washington, D.C.
Despite the resources devoted to teaching students about healthy eating in our nation's schools, as soon as they leave the classroom and step into the hallway, vending machines filled with chips, candy bars, and soda may oftentimes be the only option for grabbing a snack in between classes. But all this could change with revisions to the Child Nutrition Act, which expires this September. Members of the Healthy School Food Brigade are advocating for an update to the act, which would give the Secretary of Agriculture authority to set national nutrition standards for all food sold in schools, including the food sold in vending machines. Members of the Healthy School Food Brigade are advocating for an update to the act, which would give the Secretary of Agriculture authority to set national nutrition standards for all food sold in schools, including the food sold in vending machines, snack bars, and a la carte lines. The reauthorization of the bill is of particular concern at this time because of its potential impact on national health care reform, says Democratic Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa.
The real issue of health reform is about more than just how we pay the bills and how we extend coverage. It's about transforming our current sick care system into a genuine health care system, one that's focused on wellness, good nutrition, and preventing chronic illnesses.
Margaret Wutan, Director of Nutrition Policy at the Center for Science in the Public Interest, the group that organized the Day of Lobbying, agrees with Senator Harkin.
Families, businesses, and governments are all struggling with very high health care costs. They're breaking the budget for the federal government. And so health reform is an important issue both for the health of the country and the financial health of the government. These diseases that are caused by obesity and poor diet, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, they're very expensive. The best way to help save money on healthcare is to help people stay healthy in the first place. And starting in childhood makes the most sense.
This bill, last revised in 2004, will be voted on in the next couple of months. Passage of this legislation will mark the first significant alteration of nutritional standards since their implementation in the 1970s. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Melissa Langer with Selena Masuta.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes, headlines editor Jess Burns, and the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley, Puck Lowe and Rose Katapchi. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.